Accession number 14881, Real One.
Mr. Neil, Real One. Whereabouts were you born, please?
I was born in Cheltenham, in Gloucestershire.
Which year was that?
1922.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a school teacher. Quite a lot of the time, he was a headmaster of a local school.
Where did you have your education?
Cheltenham Grammar School.
How old were you when you left there?
18.
To go where?
To go to Cambridge.
To which college?
Christ.
So this was about 1940?
Yes, in fact it was 41. But in those days you didn't always follow exactly the university year. You know, you went when you could and you... In fact, I was supposed to be called up in the end of 1940. And then I was deferred call-up, as it was called, to allow me to get in at least a year at the university before being called up. Provided I did the year, I spent, I think it was 4 hours a week or something like that, with the University Officer Training Corps.
Just to go back a bit, did you hear Chamberlain's announcement that we were at war with Germany?
I certainly did, yes. I came back from France the night before, which was the 2nd of September, 1939. I'd been on holiday cycling in France, which was much more unusual then than it is now. And I came back on the Saturday night, and that announcement was made on Sunday morning, I think.
Did you?
Yes, Sunday morning, that's right.
Did you come out specially quickly because of the war, impending war?
No. The French mobilization had already taken place. We'd been able to see some of it and certainly see some of the effects of it because it was very difficult to buy bread, for example, in certain French places and other things. Sugar was already disappearing. But there were just two of us cycling in France and we kept to our original timetable and came back when we said we were coming back, which was regarded as complete madness by the people we met afterwards here in this country, including my parents. They all thought we should have taken the first possible boat.
What was your reaction to Chamberlain's speech?
Well, I don't remember.
Dismay?
No, I don't think it was dismay, but it was the... It was a certain amount of apprehension because it was purely from a selfish point of view. I mean, it was quite obvious that this was going to upset all the things which my teenage friends and I had were thinking of doing, and it became apparent we wouldn't be able to do them.
What did you read at Cambridge?
Well, when I first went up, I read French and German, modern languages.
And then? You changed, did you?
Well, you see, I went away for 4 years, and then I came back in 1946, and then I read economics.
Can you tell me about joining the forces?
I have very hazy memories of that. I'd been with the training corps in Cambridge, and then at the end of the term, the Cambridge term, something in July, I think it was, I was told to report to what was then known as a pre-OCTU, a pre-officers of cadet training unit, which was down in Rootham in Kent. And that was all, the usual thing. They sent you a travel warrant and you made your own way there.
How did you come to be in the intelligence corps?
I was never in the intelligence corps. I must insist on that. I was an infantry officer, and I remained commissioned in the Dorsetshire Regiment for the whole of my army career. The intelligence corps was regarded as a bit off by infantry people and gunners and others too.
In what sense was it regarded as off?
Well, it was a bit special. It was it's spooky. It's spooky in the sense of people you didn't know where they'd come from or where they, what they were up to. So unmilitary, perhaps, is the best word for it.
But you became an intelligence officer in the infantry?
No, no. I was an infantry officer for, what would it have been? About a year, I suppose. No, something under a year. I had a command of a platoon, and I did all the things which a junior infantry officer does. And then, something under a year afterwards, I was told that I was now being taken out of the infantry, and I had to go on a course to learn to become an intelligence officer. And that was where it all started.
How did you react to that news?
Well, I was delighted, because it was at a time when young and largely untrained infantry officers were being sent to Burma. And I didn't much want to go to Burma, so I was very happy that somebody in the War Office had remembered that in my file somewhere there was a note which said, "Speak some German."
This was in 43?
Let me see. I was commissioned in 42. Yes, it must have been in 43. That's right. Yeah. Yes.
What did your training consist of?
Oh, I had a lot of training. The intelligence school, the first one was at Matlock, in the old Smedley's Hydro in Matlock. And that was a long course. And then another course in Cambridge, where I lived in great luxury, in St. John's College in Cambridge, learning mainly about prisoner of war interrogation. And then other courses dealing with various other aspects of German tactics and German army structure and that sort of thing. It went on a long time, though.
How were you supposed to interrogate a POW? What was the technique?
Well, on the, what you can call the lower level, that is to say ordinary POWs, there wasn't really any technique at all. It's just a question of asking about his unit and equipment, and weapons, officers, all the things which you, any member of the forces would know normally. But then, of course, you graduated, if you were good at it, to a much higher level, where you ask people about new aircraft engines or torpedoes or radar or all sorts of things came up after that.
Presumably you had to be a specialist, did you?
Oh, yes, yes. I knew nothing whatever about that. But there was a special unit, a combined services unit, where Army and Navy and Air Force people all worked together on things like that.
But would the interrogation of a POW be one-to-one, or would there be a team of interrogators?
For an ordinary POW, it would be one-to-one, or even several-to-one, in the sense that there'd be a room full of people, and the interrogator would be asking questions of one, and then of another, and then of another. But as I say, on the higher level, where some specialist knowledge was thought to exist, there'd be a team of interrogators, usually, as I say, representing more than one service.
But what if a POW just insisted on giving name, rank, and number and nothing else?
Well, nothing much you could do about it. You could always threaten to hand him over to the Poles or the Czechs. But in practice, it didn't happen, I don't think.
Did you ever do that?
No. But some of the interrogators, of course, were Poles and Czechs. And Dutch, Norwegians.
Were they more unpleasant?
Yes, the Central Europeans, on the whole, were much more unpleasant. Yes.
Were you present at any of their interrogations?
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
So in what way would they be unpleasant?
Well, they were much more threatening. And, of course, their German, for the most part, was much better than ours. When we'd learned ours, but they'd spoken it very often almost from birth. So it made it a lot easier to threaten people when you had a complete command of slang.
But were they threatening just in their manner, or were they threatening to have them shot, or what?
No, it was mostly threatening in their manner, I suppose, yes.
Did they...
But this was a very short period in my experience, you know. I was only... I was an outsider, rather, on all this, because it became quite obvious very soon that I was not the... I was not the sort of person who was going to be a professional POW interrogator at all.
But did you find those POWs whom you did interrogate would spill the beans, or did they just stick to the Geneva Protocol?
Oh, well, it all depended. It depended on their background, on their rank, how they saw the war going, all sorts of things. On the whole, the army were easier to get things out of than the Navy. There seemed to be a degree of discipline among in the German Navy that didn't exist in the Army.
And the Air Force? The Luftwaffe?
Yes. Well, I didn't see many Air Force people. I can't really say about them.
Did any of the POWs tell you anything very useful?
Well, what we're talking about, mind, is a training period. So it didn't really matter to me whether they told me anything useful or not. And I wasn't really in a position to decide whether what they were saying was useful, because I was still very much an apprentice. Later on, I talked to POWs who did tell me all sorts of useful things. But what is useful and what is not useful is very tricky, mind. If they mentioned that their commanding officer was Schmidt, this would serve to confirm, in some cases, that they were part of a recently constituted battle group of which you'd heard stories, perhaps, or had a radio message or something about, that this was Battle Group Schmidt. And so they didn't think it was of any importance to say, I'm now under command of Schmidt. But the interrogator, of course, knew that it was very important to have that confirmed. That's the sort of thing which happened. But that happened in the field later.
One of the reasons I'm asking is because I've interviewed British POWs, especially flyers, who were interrogated at a place called Dulag Luft near Frankfurt.
Yeah.
And they told me about the kind of techniques the Germans employed with them, such as offering them cigarettes and so on to soften them up. Was there anything like of that kind of thing on our side?
Well, there again, I think everything depends on what you're aiming at. If you're doing a quick tactical interrogation of somebody who's on his way back to the cage, as it was called, then you wouldn't have time to introduce any inducements or anything like that. But if you're after somebody who you think has got some specialist knowledge of a newly introduced torpedo on a U-boat, then this is the sort of thing where the interrogation might go on for a fortnight, and then all sorts of tricks would be used. You know, the softening up or the harsh treatment, or the threatening, or the leaving to stew for a little while. I mean, all the usual tricks which every interrogator always has. But that's only worth doing if you're really going to get something very special out of it.
Later on, did you do any lengthy interrogation?
No. But, of course, I used the material coming out of interrogations. And I had a number of friends who were involved in it all the time.
So we were talking about the training that you were doing as a POW interrogator. Mm-hmm. What was the next stage for you in the war?
Well, after finishing all these courses and being regarded more or less as an intelligence officer, I say more or less because you don't know what level you've attained, I was put into a sort of reserve of intelligence officers, ready for what was obviously going to be the landing in Normandy. And every sort of specialty had to have a reserve, as people were going to disappear. And while I was a reserve intelligence officer, I sat in London, very posh place, I think it was Eaton Square, and spent something like a fortnight before D-Day, reading mail from the forces. I'm sure you know that all the mail in the war was censored by the officer concerned. The officers had to sign the mail that their own troops or whatever they were sending home, sending out. And officers were allowed to sign their own mail, but they had to sign everybody else's as well. Well, that was a censorship idea. But the War Office also had the idea that because there was going to be a landing in Europe very shortly, it was very important to know, first of all, what the morale of the British Army was like. Stories were circulating that morale was not very high because the troops were beginning to resent the fact that they were surrounded and outnumbered by highly paid Americans all over the south of England. So the War Office was interested in the morale of the army, but it was also interested in knowing whether anything was getting through the local censorship and whether any indication was being given by people who were probably not meaning to, but little bits and pieces of things were getting through. So we had they had a unit there in the centre of London, which was staffed by all sorts of people who were like me, sort of reinforcement, reserve people, who were reading mail mainly for the first of those two reasons. That is to say, to try and form an estimate of what was being said and thought and felt by the chaps who were going across the channel very shortly. And that was a fascinating job, absolutely fascinating. It was a sort of market research, you'd call it now, or Gallup poll, I suppose, except that it wasn't being done scientifically. It was being done on the basis of impressions, really. You didn't end up by saying 95% of the letters I've seen are very cheerful. You ended up by saying, well, they seem to be a bit worried about not getting enough fags or something like that. And so you were reporting impressions, but it was very, very interesting. Very interesting. I could cheerfully have done that for a bit longer.
What impression did you get of morale?
Oh, and the impression I got, it was extremely high. Extremely high. That people were really very, very cheerful and more or less looking forward to getting into action.
Did you detect any weak points at all?
Not really, no. No. There were the usual grumbling and muttering about local things, you know. And we don't like this new chap who's been put in command of our platoon, or the NAFI van was late again last week, or that sort of thing. But apart from that, no. As always, they were much more worried about conditions in their families and among the civilian population than they were about their own situation.
What kind of worries there?
Oh, well, the rationing, air raids, and the usual thing about what their wives were up to when they were away.
Did you detect any anti-American feeling on that basis?
Yes, a certain amount. There was a certain amount, yes. That's true. Yes, overpaid and over here, you know, and all the old stories, which continued, I suppose.
Because the Germans tried to play on that, did they not?
They did. They certainly did. Lord Hawhor did, didn't he? Yes. Yes.
Did you go across to Normandy yourself?
Not on D-Day, no, but shortly afterwards. About 5 days afterwards, I think it was.
What was your crossing like?
An absolute nightmare, which I shall never forget. Terrible. I mean, it was the weather, of course, that made it bad. We went in LCI, I believe it was. Anyway, it wasn't very big. It seemed to me much too small to go across the channel. And then the most peculiar gang of people. All these specialists from various trades and units, all of whom were being sent as reinforcements, including some people who were a concert party for ENSA. You know, the performers who performed for the troops. But they had to go, when they went abroad, they had to go under, not under command, but under the responsibility of an officer. So they were parceled out among a whole lot of officers. You know, you look after these three, and you look after these three. That sort of thing. I have a memory in my mind. I have a... I can't get out of my mind the fact that Charlie Chester was there, but I don't believe he was. I believe I could probably find out from the records that he wasn't, but I still connect Charlie Chester with going across the channel on that little boat.
So you were all vomiting, were you?
Oh, yes. And we had this self-heating soup, which made it worse. Did you know that there's such a thing as self-heating soup?
I've heard of it.
Yes. I wish they'd bring it back. It would be most useful for mountaineers and people, wouldn't it? You touch a lighted cigarette to a thing that looked like a fuse sticking out of the middle. And it went for a minute or so, and then went out. And when it went out, the soup was ready.
Did you run into the enemy at all, crossing?
No.
So you didn't go across as an organized unit?
Oh, no.
What happened?
All these odds and ends were collected in fields. We started in Hythe in Kent, went to Southsea, and then in fields around Southsea, people were collected up and formed into little groups. They were all sorts of people. I remember a group of military police and the ENSA people and a group of signalers, and they were all reinforcements, you see.
Where did you go to?
In France?
In Normandy. Yes.
In Normandy, a place called Port-en-Bessin, which is next to Arromanches.
To do what?
Well, I didn't do anything. I just walked up the beach and followed the instructions of the beach. I don't know what he was called now. What was he called? The beach major, was it?
Beach master,
was it? Yeah.
But did you join a unit there?
No. As I say, there were these groups of people, really ad hoc groups, who I suppose somebody had the authority to issue them with rations and everything else. And I remember camping out in a field in Normandy for several days. Mainly, I camped out with the military police because they were such good scroungers, the military police. You know, they could get anything. As soon as they put on their red cap, people came and offered them things.
To ingratiate themselves?
Yes. We had vast stocks of Normandy butter and Camembert and Calvados. All sorts of things. I even sent a Camembert home to my parents from the field out just off the beach. As soon as the post started working, which was very, very soon after it.
What was your main work in Normandy?
Well, immediately after this, I was picked out of this gang, this lot, and told to report to the main headquarters, Second Army. Because what had been foreseen had happened, that people had been killed. The intelligence officer of one of the parachute battalions had been killed, and so somebody from Second Army was sent to replace him, and that meant that somebody had to replace the man at Second Army. And that was the way it was working all the time. So I was told to report Second Army.
Where were they located when you joined them?
Well, they were only a few hundred yards away because there wasn't much room in the beachhead. They were at a place called Crilly. Isn't it Crilly? We've been back there, haven't we? Montgomery was in the chateau, one side of the road, and Second Army was at the other side of the road. In tents and caravans and ditches and things.
Who were you working under there?
Well, I was working under the same people I worked under for the whole of the rest of the war, which was GSIA. GSIA, which is General Staff Intelligence. A is enemy, information about the enemy. B is counterintelligence. Stop the enemy getting information about you. S is signals intelligence. I don't know how many more there are. I knew those three anyway. And this was GSIA, which had a GSO1, a colonel, a GSO2, a major, and a GSO3, a captain. And the captain had 5 or 6 intelligence officers to do his bidding, specializing mainly in different things.
What was your speciality?
Well, of course, I didn't have one when I started, but I very rapidly got one because I simply took the specialty of the chap whose place I was taking. And my specialty became and remained throughout the whole campaign enemy order of battle.
Was it easy to get information about the enemy's order of battle?
No, well, it's like doing a... Well, I've often compared it since to doing the Times crossword. It's partly building up information, but partly inspiration. Intuition, almost.
This is the names and kinds of units which the Allies were facing in Normandy.
That's right. What the units were. Particularly, probably the most important thing was the identification of the divisions. And then within the division, what their strengths were, how many battalions or regiments they had within the division, because by that time, by 44, this varied very much. Some German units were much stronger than others. Some which had been transferred from further east, for example, were very weak. So you had to know what was within those divisions, and not only in the number of men, but also, of course, the weapons and the armament, everything about them. And if possible, a good deal of detail, like names of the commanders, previous history of the units, and an assessment of the not only of their strength but of their morale and everything, anything that could be useful to other people, not only of course to your own people who were taking action against them, but also to people like the POW interrogators, who might be interrogating a chap from that unit in 2 or 3 days' time, and who would find it very useful to be able to say, ah, you're from Miller's regiment, are you? And show them that you knew more about them than they thought you did. So there was a constant turnover of this type of information.
What were your own main sources of information about the enemy order of battle?
Oh, they came from all over the place. A lot came from interrogation. Not just asking questions, but also studying pay books, identity documents, letters which the prisoners had in their pockets, photographs and that sort of thing they were carrying with them. Captured documents, such as particularly maps. Radio intercepts, of course, are very important. Air photo interpretation, showing where they were, and the photo interpreters could often tell you how many people are likely to be in that area. You know, a field with people dug in a field.